This episode of Bitch Propaganda was recorded on Thursday, October 22nd at the Bitch headquarters in Portland, Oregon. Just a warning, the following episode contains language that might be considered questionable, including the word bitch, of course. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode of Bitch Propaganda. It's like The View, except Lily Tomlin won't return our phone calls. I'm Kelsey Wallace, the web editor at Bitch, and with me today is...
Andy Zeisler. I'm the editorial director here at Bitch.
I'm Sara Rehani. I'm the editorial intern.
And today we are going to talk about sexy Halloween costumes, feminism and weddings, and why America loves musicals on television. So... let's start with sexy Halloween costumes. I actually put a call out on our Facebook page the other day saying that we were maybe going to be talking about this topic, and people were showing me the most ridiculous examples of the sexy Halloween costumes you can get. Yes, it's always been kind of the joke. I mean, I think Mean Girls kind of showed it pretty well of like, oh, Halloween is a time for women to take something that they like and make it sexy and then dress that way. But it does seem to me like it's getting even crazier. Like, this year you can get a sexy Border Patrol costume, sexy illegal alien.
Sexy environmentalist, which is basically, it appears to be basically an extremely small green sundress.
Right, environmental wear. So I don't know if anyone wants to kick us off with, you know, why do you think this is such a trend? Is it women who are actually wanting to dress this way, or is it costume manufacturers that are just kind of putting it on us, or is it a combination?
I think it's partly because there's just nothing else there. You can't dress up as anything that's not sexy unless you're like a hot dog, which could be construed as sexy.
I think it's sexy.
Well, as someone who's going as a sexy banana this year, I would say that, yeah, I mean, I think it has reached sort of a tipping point where everyone understands that it's kind of a joke that any costume marketed toward women is going to be marketed as a sexy costume.
I thought it was interesting. One of the people who responded to the Facebook post was, well, it does work as a stripper. And she was saying that 1 month out of the year, the store where she buys her work clothes, like stiletto heels and thong underwear, is like jam-packed with women who, in her words, you know, the rest of the year look down on her and judge her for what she wears, but when, you know, there's one day a year where they can't wait to get in line to wear the same thing. And So, you know, she was saying, is this just an outlet for at least some women to dress the way they secretly wish they could dress all the time, but they feel like they'd get too judged for it?
I think that was addressed in the Mean Girls, when they bring it up in Mean Girls, it's like the one day that women can dress as slutty as they want and none of the other girls can say anything about
it. Yeah, it's true. That was sort of the key part, is that none of the other girls could say anything about it. And I think that's probably true. You know, I mean, I think that there are, you know, those costumes were sort of sold in fetish shops and shops that mainly sex workers shopped in for a long time because they have a very specific
purpose.
They have a very specific purpose. They have to do with role play. And, you know, probably a lot of people would be inclined to make role play a part of their intimate lives, but they just, there's so much sort of, not shame, but there's so much judgment around it. And maybe Halloween, you know, maybe Halloween does provide that option and, you know, everyone else is doing it. I don't know. I think what bothers me is that it really does seem to be trickling down to costumes for, you know, not grown women, but young girls.
Mm-hmm.
And that's incredibly disturbing.
Yeah, it does seem, and I don't have kids myself, and I don't interact that much with people that are of kind of young Halloween costume age, but that was another thing that I was seeing on our Facebook thread was just like, you know, somebody's younger sister or somebody's daughter who's 6th, 7th grade and wants to dress like a sexy firefighter or like, and I mean, maybe the girls wouldn't use the word sexy, but it's definitely like midriff showing, you know,
short skirt,
fishnets. It's just
like, it used to be that when little girls dressed up as fairies, it was like a long fairy gown thing and like a huge hat or whatever. But now it's like, oh, if you're a fairy, you wear a tiny dress. It's like a Tinkerbell fairy.
Right. I think we all watched a clip of Tina Fey on Letterman last week talking about her daughter who's only 4 years old. And, you know, Tina wants to let her daughter pick her own Halloween costume.
How is your daughter Halloween? Of course, the big kids holiday.
It's coming up, and she's four now. She's very well. Thank you for asking. And she's, this is the first year where she has an opinion about what she wants to be for Halloween. Because when they're babies, you can just stuff them in.
Of course.
You're going to be a ham sandwich. We're all going to laugh at you. You know? but she has her own opinions this year, and we've got it narrowed down. She either wants to be some kind of Barbie butterfly princess.
Yes.
Or the other thing that was her idea was she also pitched being a robot that eats bacon.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, I'm trying to play it cool. I want her to be a robot that eats bacon.
Yeah.
But I'm trying not to, you know, push it too much.
But I mean, it does say something that a four-year-old would already have the desire to be a Barbie butterfly princess for Halloween. And I think, you know, young girls are kind of always, at least, you know, in the near future, going to be in that kind of princess mode. But especially combining it with the Barbie. I mean, maybe it's just because I'm not around little kids as much anymore, but it just seems creepy to me, like this big boobs and short skirts.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I would say I have less of a problem that a four-year-old wants to be a Barbie butterfly princess if that same four-year-old wanted to be a sexy nurse.
True.
You know, that would, I think that would, that we'd really have a problem. And frankly, I think we might already be there.
It just seems like there's a divide where there's costumes for babies that are cute and round, and they're like a sunflower or, I don't know, maybe a little devil, and it's adorable. And then once it hits like four, it starts to become like sexualized, and it just gets more and more sexualized as they get older. And then I think you also reach a middle age where there are women who just dress up like pumpkins again, like adorable babies who are pumpkins, because there are no costumes for women above 40.
Right.
I was just having this conversation with my mom, and she doesn't know what to be for Halloween because I don't think she wants to be like a sexy nurse, but she was saying that she's having a hard
time.
I don't want her to want to be a sexy nurse. But I mean, just kind of that she was saying that like she wanted to look cute and that she just kind of couldn't figure out like, oh,
what
you know, I want to be a little fun.
Yeah.
Right. And especially, I mean, my mom and, you know, me also, actually, I think a lot of people just like are, number one, probably wouldn't feel comfortable in some of the sexy costumes that are available, and also probably wouldn't fit into them. I mean,
but let me just get back to the kids' costumes, because I think it's more than the girls' costumes, because I was at Target recently, and all the costumes for little boys have all these really creepy sort of articulated foam muscles.
I noticed those, yeah.
And you really can't get a little boy's superhero costume, whether it's Spider-Man or Batman or, you know, like a pirate, without it having these sort of weird sculpted muscles.
Yeah.
And as someone who, you know, grew up in the 70s where all the superhero costumes were like they were essentially like a garbage bag with superhero features drawn on them. This just strikes me as a very, very strange and sort of pernicious development.
Yeah.
Well, I just think it's weird to set the bar so high for a 7-year-old boy. Like, well,
if you really want
to look good, you should have big biceps, even though you're a child. And, you know, I think it's fine if adults, like, want to dress sexy or fun on Halloween, but I think there's a weird push for it to just be that, and then also, like we're saying, for kids to be included in that push. It's just like Halloween is about these kind of idealized bodies for men and women, and everybody should make their costume a part of that.
And that's exactly what seems to be happening, and it's just, you know, again, like, it would be fine if it were just confined to adults, although then we'd have to see some male parody in these in these sexy costumes. But the fact that kids are getting, you know, essentially they're being dictated these sort of weird body ideals in their Halloween costumes, it's ridiculous, and it's sort of upsetting.
Yeah, I don't know what the solution is besides, I guess, parents just kind of putting their feet down and saying...
Homemade costumes are not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then you have to be the uncool parent. And I think about this a lot as someone who will probably be an uncool parent, mm-hmm. you know, to my now one-year-old son who doesn't get a choice in his costume this year but will have one in the next few years. Like, I don't want to be the person who says, you know what, you can't be Spider-Man because the musculature on that costume freaks me out. I'm going to make you a Spider-Man costume out of a set of thermal long johns. And he's going to be like, oh, Mom.
I'm not going to look muscular enough.
I need to look muscular at school. It's kindergarten. For gosh sakes, it's time to be buff. All right, well, let's shift our focus just a little bit, although costumes could still be involved in the discussion somewhat. This past weekend in the New York Times vows section, Jessica Valenti's marriage to Andrew Golis, I think, was featured. And for those of you who don't know, Jessica is the editor at Feminist Thing, and she's also written two books about feminism in recent years. And it looks like a lot of people have reactions to the fact that she got married in the first place, the fact that the marriage was covered in the vows section, and the reactions seem to be kind of a mix of, you're a hypocrite because you're a feminist who has spoken out against the institution of marriage, yet you're still entering into it. And P.S., now you're in the vows section, so you're even taking it, like, that much further, so you know. And then also combined with, okay, you're saying, you know, you being Jessica, that, you know, you don't want to take your husband's last name, that you want to kind of maintain this autonomy in your relationship. Like, why are you even getting married in the first place? Like, what's the point of this? And so it seems like this is a chance for a lot of people to voice their opinions when it comes to feminism and marriage. So, Andy, you are married and a feminist, so I don't know if you wanted to start.
Do you wake up every morning and just ask yourself,
why did I do this?
Well, it's funny because this is not, you know, this has come up for me in the past. And to me, I answer the question the same way that I answer the same way I talk about, you know, things like knitting and crafting. You know, I'm a feminist and I knit. I'm a feminist and I'm married. Does my being a feminist make those things a feminist act? No. Marriage is, you know, inherently a holdover from a very different patriarchal time. The fact that for most people it doesn't have to be that now hasn't really changed the way that people think about it as an institution. So I would never say my getting married was consciously a feminist act. I mean, the way that my husband and I got married is, you know, it was very low key. It was very secular. We wrote our own vows. Nobody gave me away. You know, it was very casual. And I think that's the way a lot of women traditionally get married. But I think when you call yourself a feminist and you get married and you're a very public figure like Jessica, people want to talk about it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do seem to be kind of coming back to the question of, well, then what's the point of this? You know, what's the point of getting married? And I do think that's an interesting question to ask, because at this point, it's not as much, well, hopefully it's not about this for anyone, although I think for some people, maybe it still is about kind of like the woman being given over to the man and now they have the same last name. And I mean, we know the feminist arguments against marriage, which are valid, you know. Yeah. And so then, I don't know, I mean, because I'm not married, but I also don't feel against marriage. I mean, you know, I think I don't consider it, you know, bad for feminists to get married, but I just think, okay, well then what is the point, you know, more cultural, or is it also, it seems like a lot of the arguments are ignoring the, you know, legal and financial benefits of getting married. I mean, we're definitely in a culture that, you know, that supports marriage, and it's married couples who can more easily purchase a home and have shared health insurance and have rights that, as we know from a lot of the gay marriage debates, non-married couples don't have the same rights as married couples. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, that factors in too. And just because you're a feminist, does that mean that you should eschew those benefits, you know, in order to kind of uphold your political ideology? And maybe you should, I don't know, mm-hmm. but...
Well, maybe it's not so much a question. For most people, it's probably not a question of, are my ideals worth it versus can I afford to do it? Because if you're living with someone and you're in a committed relationship and maybe you have children together, sometimes you just can't afford to make the financial sacrifices that go along with doing those things and not being married and not having the same abilities as a married couple has.
I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people say, we don't want to get married until everyone else can. And that's, you know, that's great. And if that's if that's how you feel, that's great. But your not getting married isn't really moving
gay rights forward.
There's nothing wrong with making a personal choice that isn't political and using it to talk about the ways that, you know, gay marriage could benefit. And I think Jessica and her husband, from what I understand, did that. You know, they had guests in lieu of presents make donations to
a No on Eight campaign.
Yeah, I think so, a No on Eight campaign. And, you know, I think that's great. It's you know, knowing Jessica and really respecting her and liking her as a person, I think it's great that she was so transparent about her decision and really thought about what her readers might object to, what they might want to weigh in on. But, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, she's definitely not the first feminist who's gotten married, and you're allowed to, as a public person, have a personal life and not have to answer to the people that your, you know, your audience.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she did is great. People who are acting like she somehow owes them an explanation are as misguided as everyone who thought, you know, Ani DiFranco owed them an explanation when she got married.
Right.
You know, it's really ultimately none of their business. You know, it just made me think, like, well, if she wants to have kids, is she going to have to check with them too?
Right.
You
know? Hey, everyone, I mean, is it cool?
Yeah.
Well, and I also think, and I'm paraphrasing Dan Savage, this is something that he was saying in a podcast of his a while back, but, you know, somebody called in and said, I'm uncomfortable, like, I'm a gay man, I'm uncomfortable going to my brother's heterosexual wedding because I can't get married, and, like, how should I navigate this? Or, I don't even remember, I think that was the jumping off point for the conversation, and Dan Savage was basically saying, like, the way to change this institution is to participate in it, you know? You should go there and be a positive presence at the wedding, just like I've heard him advise people that say, oh, we're not going to get married until everyone can, and he's saying, your intentions are good, but by doing that, you're actually proving the argument that gay relationships are affecting the institution of marriage, mm-hmm. and that if you really want to affect change, you should get married and do kind of what Jessica and Andrew, it sounds like, have done, and use that to kind of publicize some of the problem. And I think the same can be said about, you know, feminism in marriage, which it's, you know, maybe the shift should be toward how to make this, like, a more feminist institution instead of just, like, if you're a feminist, don't do this.
Yeah.
It's like, well, and I think a lot of feminists do this all the time. I mean, I don't think this is new for Jessica and Andrew, but just, like, you know, we're going to negotiate the ceremony and have it be what we want, and our relationship is going to be what we're comfortable with. And, you know, to me, I think some of the criticism that she's gotten is partially just because people, I was reading a broadsheet roundtable discussion, and Kate Harding was saying that, you know, it's like people seem to not want her to try to have it both ways. Like, oh, you're speaking out against these problems, but you're also going to do it. So how do you get to make a living being a feminist and also get married? Like, shouldn't you have to give something up? But
there's,
I don't think that's true.
Like a feeling that it's like, oh, you're a feminist. Like, aren't you supposed to hate men? How can you be getting married?
Or also just like, oh, you are kind of famous and you're also pretty and you don't get to get married like other girls and be a feminist. You know, I mean,
yeah.
It's just like,
yeah, a lot of this does seem to be, you know, a willful ignoring of the fact that most people are, you know, contain multitudes and
yeah.
manage to have some level.
How can
you
be pretty and a feminist at the same time?
Exactly. I mean, there really is, especially when it comes to feminism, there really does seem this need often within feminist circles themselves to really sort of essentialize everything and
mm-hmm.
and really not be able to sort of hold a bunch of contradictions at once. And,
right. You can't do this and this, which we all know is just not true.
Yeah.
You know? Speaking of contradictions, we were having a discussion earlier this week that I thought would be interesting for propaganda. We were talking about Glee, the musical television show that is sweeping the nation. And
if you say so.
And well, people
it
are
is,
freaking
yeah.
out about this.
It is sweeping the nation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it started out, and we had a blog post about it here on the Bitch blog that was basically saying, yes, Glee seems like it could be a fun show, but it is also just relying on a lot of really kind of trite stereotypes, and it could be really clunky. And I was kind of wondering, I mean, I've been watching it since it started, just like, where is this going to go? And where it seems to have gone is to, like, right straight into the heart of everyone who has a television blog, or, I mean, you know, now, like, Madonna has loaned, has given permission for her entire catalog to be used on the show. There was a Neil Diamond song on this past episode, and Neil Diamond himself was tweeting during the episode.
That actually was a great rendition of Stay
Carolina. Yeah,
they had Josh Groban on it.
Yeah, Josh Groban was on it. You know, Joss Whedon is going to direct an episode and perform, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah, Neil Diamond was tweeting during the episode, like, about how good he thought it was. I mean,
anybody? Oh, come on, guys. It's like you're daring me to start dancing.
I will.
I've been working on something.
Oh, yeah?
It's my personal tribute to a musical Jewish icon.
Well, fantastic. Let's hear it.
Where it began, I can't begin to know it, but then I know it's growing strong. Wasn't the spring, and spring became summer. Who'd have believed you'd come along?
People are just, it's like, people cannot wait to get on this bandwagon of a show that is basically, like, about musical theater dorks.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say that it is my sincere belief that most people have a musical theater dork living inside them. And this show is really bringing all those musical theater dorks out with a vengeance. But I also think, like, Glee is coming into a context that has gotten very, like a TV context that has gotten very, like, up with cheese in the past few years. Like, Dancing with the Stars, Skating with Celebrities, So You Think You Can Dance. There's a sense of, like, earnest, let's put on a show kind of performance that's become really unironically embraced. And I think, you know, had Glee come out maybe 5 years ago, it wouldn't necessarily be sweeping the nation. But because we've already shown that we really want to see, like, Tom DeLay and Marie Osmond and Donny Osmond and all these people dance and sing, Glee is sort of the right show for right now.
I think it's interesting that in so many ways, besides musical theater, on television, it seems like people are, you know, cynical, and this is kind of a depressing time for a lot of people economically and politically. Maybe things are getting a little bit better, but they have not been great. And, you know, maybe it is a chance to just be like, you know what, I'm tired of being cynical for an hour. I just want to, like, smile and see high school students
jump
perform
and
Journey songs and dance and just feel good about it.
I feel like there's kind of a divide where it's like, okay, you're living in this depressed economic time, etc. There's two kinds of shows you can watch on TV right now. There's the ones with the incredibly wealthy people, like Gossip Girl or most of reality television. Weird, semi-celebrity kind of people doing things, even like sitcoms like Gossip Girl and that kind of thing. You can just see them doing horrible things and being mean to each other and wearing beautiful clothes. Or you can watch this incredibly sincere, like, the complete opposite of the jaded wealthy people.
Look at Susan Boyle and how much people loved seeing someone who was not that conventionally attractive and did not seem like, I mean, she was just, like, the world's favorite underdog for just having a really great singing voice.
Yeah. I mean, hers was like a perfect musical theater dork story. Mm-hmm. In that she came out of nowhere, no one expected anything from her, and she sort of vindicated herself. You know, you could sort of, I mean, personally, I imagined her thinking, like, in your face, everyone who ever thought I sucked or was just this.
I think I did read a quote along those lines in an article about her.
Did she say in your face?
I hope
not
she
in your
did.
Face,
I would love that.
A paraphrase of in your face.
I hope
sort of
she
like,
did.
I always knew I could do it, and, like, my mom loves me. And
it doesn't matter. They don't have a boyfriend because they've got my songs.
Yeah, she was just like,
sorry,
mom always said I was a great singer, and she was right.
Yeah. Well, then, on another but similar note, you know, do you find yourselves liking these programs, or do you get it, like, this musical theater obsession, or does it, you know?
Something like Dancing with the Stars, I really don't, because I find the people they have on that show to be off-putting.
What, Aaron Carter? You're not.
Tom DeLay?
Yeah.
What is off-putting about Tom DeLay?
You just, that?
I really need to, yeah, I really need your explanation.
The glittery elephant cowboy,
yeah,
outfit.
Yeah, I'm racking my brain.
To be the cha-cha.
It was just like, and it's even more off-putting that he fractured both his feet doing that show. No. That sounds horrible, and I almost feel bad for Tom DeLay.
I feel that is karma.
He danced too hard, everyone. He gave too much of himself.
Yeah.
The hammer.
He sacrificed himself on the altar of Dancing with the Stars for your entertainment. I, like, Dancing with the Stars, I really just find the people on that show, like, too... I can't get behind them, I can't root for them, because I know they're not underdogs. They're just creepy has-beens.
That makes sense.
With something like Glee, where you have a character who's this high school kid, or even High School Musical to a lesser degree, where they're just supposed to be kids, and I think part of it on Glee is the fact that there's a lot of attention paid to the fact that they're in Glee, so everybody looks down on them at their school, and, like, they reference that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always a reason to, like, get behind them and, like, root for them.
I like the earnestness, and I do think it's funny. I have a hard time with some of the kind of exaggerated stereotypes of some of the characters, especially the adult women. I think they've gotten a little bit better with the OCD germaphobe counselor. Like, mm-hmm. They've kind of scaled her back a little bit. But, you know, the other adult women are, I mean, the Jane Lynch character, Sue Sylvester, I love,
yeah.
But, you know, clearly she's kind of on the opposite end. And then you've got, like, Mr. Schuster's kind of conniving wife who's materialistic. Mm-hmm. And so I heard the argument, actually, it was June Thomas on a Slate Gab Fest who was saying, I would like Glee, but I just feel like the show hates women.
I think that's a really good point, because all of the female characters, I feel like maybe with the exception of Mercedes, who's like, you know, I'm using air quotes here, the, you know, the sassy black Glee Club member, most of the women and girls are portrayed as kind of really in some way dependent on / at the mercy of their male counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think, like, viciously ambitious in different ways.
In a way that's, like, used for a comedic effect. Like,
yeah.
You know.
Like, she's trying so hard.
That's definitely true of Rachel and Sue,
yeah.
For sure.
And Mr. Schuster's wife,
mm-hmm.
Who's, you know, determined to, you know, she had this hysterical pregnancy, and her and her sister's solution to this was to actually just get a baby, sort of raising Arizona style.
Yeah, and be fake pregnant for 9 months, which worked on Days of Our Lives, but there's more of a suspension of disbelief for me on Days of Our Lives than there is with Glee. I'm like, would your husband never touch you, ever? You're wearing a pillow under your shirt.
But, I mean, if we're going to go according to the stereotype, pregnant women are creepy and disgusting.
You'd never
so
touch them.
Of course you would never touch a pregnant
yeah.
woman.
And I do like the show. I don't want to be, like, a total Glee hater. But once I heard June Thomas say that, I realized how much I had been ignoring on purpose because I really liked just some of the musical
I sort
numbers
of have
the
same
and the
feeling
jokes.
About 30 Rock, where I'm like, I know that a lot of this is, like, kind of misogynistic, but it's still really funny.
So I'm in this. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think the trend is going away anytime soon. I don't know if anyone sees a change, but...
Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, I'm pretty excited to see where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Having grown up with sort of musical theater geek parents and you know, acting in musicals when I was a kid.
So yeah, I think you're right. There's a musical theater dork inside everyone.
Inside everyone.
And that's no good. Matter how you know, there's yeah. nothing wrong with letting it out. And I really like so far the musical selections they are making on the show. Most of the songs I'm really happy to hear. I even really liked, I'm forgetting her name, but the guidance counselor's performance of I Could Have Danced All Night in the bridal store in last night's episode. Found myself weirdly touched by it. So it speaks to the power of the music. But anyway, let's go ahead and move on to our bitch faves. Sara, are you faving anything this week?
I think I'm going to fave pumpkin cupcakes because I have been making them a lot because they're so good. You just like make... You do a recipe like you're doing a white cake or a yellow cake, but instead of putting milk, you just put canned pumpkin and lots of cinnamon.
She made some for us last week, and they were really good.
They really were.
I just keep making them. I ate, like, 4 in one day. I was kind of fat.
Andy?
I had trouble with this one, because, I want to talk about this, but I also feel like there's something inherently wrong with picking this as a fave, but I'm going to just say it. It's Man Shops Globe on the Sundance Channel, which is basically the story of the guy who he buys things for Anthropology, the company. He buys things for them to knock off or for store displays. And he basically just, the show is basically him just traveling to different cities and buying stuff. And it's amazing because there's a whole dramatic arc around him needing something like a really big dramatic backdrop. And you know, it's the whole like he's running from one flea market to the next in France, and you know, I get really absorbed in it. I really hope he finds that.
That sounds
it's gonna be good.
I mean, it's all just for like Anthropology to sell and for their window displays.
No, it's also for them to knock off. And for instance, and I'm getting all jargony. I used to work for Pottery Barn. And this is how stores do it. They source things from around the globe, and then they bring it back, and people in their company make it. So let's say he finds, like, a very cool bed. Like, Anthropology will knock off the bed. They'll create the bed, and then they'll sell it.
Exactly.
So there's some, like, cultural appropriation issues.
Like, I'm not going to be able to walk into an Anthropology or a Pottery Barn now without wondering, like, how much work went into all of these
things.
Yeah,
no, that's how it's done. That's totally how it's done.
Come on, it's postmodernism. You know, we're all in the same...
I can't handle it.
We're just regurgitating the same ideas anyway.
There's nothing new under the sun, Sara.
Sorry.
It's like when I go into Cosplus and I just pretend that everything there was, like,
actually gotten at a very cute little bazaar.
Yeah. I just pretended that I could walk in and out.
It's not mass-produced at all.
It's our desire for that earnestness, you know? We don't like a knockoff.
There it is.
Well, I'm gonna go ahead and say 2 this week because I had a hard time picking. And one's more serious and one's a little more frivolous. So there's a new-ish blog that started a few weeks ago called FWD, Feminists with Disabilities for a Way Forward. And I've been reading it just this past week, and I think it's really great. I don't know if anyone else has had a chance to check it out, but it's just a really great forum for, obviously, feminists with disabilities to talk about what their experiences are like. And also, as somebody who at this point in my life is not dealing with a disability, there's just a lot of really valuable information for, you know, just kind of how to interact with people as either a, you know, a typically abled or a differently abled person. And just, I mean, navigating something like, how am I going to get from my car into this building? Or what if I have chronic pain disorder, so people don't know that I have a disability, but I do have one? And then also, they do pop culture stuff. Like, there was a pretty good kind of review of that film, The Orphan, which I won't give away the spoiler, but...
Oh, I've heard the spoiler.
Yeah.
I have too.
Yeah. If you've heard the spoiler, it could relate to the disability community. But anyway, it's a smart blog, and it's interesting. I mean, I think I'm in a position of privilege, as a lot of people I know are, to maybe not think about these issues as much, and it's nice to hear from people who... you know, who are dealing with them all the time and have really great things to say. So I would check it out. I'll put the link on our blog. And my second fave is the band Dead Man's Bones, which features frontman Oscar-nominated actor Ryan Gosling. Not only have I had a crush on him since he was on Breaker High in the mid-90s, but they're coming to Portland on Sunday. I'm going to the show. And originally I was interested in the band solely because of Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
But now I'm really interested in them because they're really cool. And you can get the album, you can stream it on their MySpace page. And if you are in a position to go to see one of their live shows, they're having, at least at this particular one, a zombie talent show contest as part of the show. And a local boys choir is going to perform with them, and they're going to sing like scary Halloween songs. So I think it's going to be really fun, and I like when one of my celebrity crushes turns out to seem like a little bit cool in real life too. So,
but what if you meet him and he's a douche?
I know. I probably won't even try to meet him.
This
just,
band,
you know,
sounds way better than Jared Leto's band, 30 Seconds to Mars.
I think it
or
sounds
Keanu
like
Reeves,
yeah,
as Dog Star.
So that wraps it up for this week's Popaganda. Thanks so much for tuning in, and you can get more of our podcasts at our iTunes channel or by visiting bitchmagazine.org/audio.
This episode of Bitch Popaganda contained audio clips from The Late Show with David Letterman and Glee, both via YouTube.com, as well as the band Dead Man's Bones. Thanks to Andy and Sarah, and to you for tuning in.